Shalom. Did I say that correctly? Okay. So we will go ahead and start with Lisa. All right. So thank you guys all for being here. Thanks again to the California Rare Book School for sponsoring. Also, thanks to Daniel Slive, who I understand had something to do with that sponsorship. But you said so as much. But when the call for papers came out for this a couple months ago last fall, I forwarded it out to the Salaam listserv, and we put together this panel. It was originally also going to have Jennifer Osorio from UCLA on the panel, and she was going to speak about distinctive collections as a coming model in academic libraries. But she is completely in the middle of transitioning UCLA to said model and felt that she wouldn't have enough to talk about, where I think she would have had plenty of interesting things to talk about. As such, I chose to take my talk from being just about what one subject librarian can do to work with special collections to also talking about distinctive collections in the context of, one, a university that library that is not moving to such a model, but still a very influential conversation in our profession and in the fields that we work in. To talk about it a little bit, distinctive collections are bringing together special collections, area studies collections, and often topical collections such as an exceptionally strong arts library or other kind of more niche collections, such as maybe like the turfgrass collection at Michigan State or transportation at Northwestern or something like the Kinsey Institute at Indiana, and saying these are things that we have that are special to what we do. The literature discusses a lot about the commonalities of distinctive collections in terms of the common concerns and issues that we talk about, besides just that we collect weird stuff. It talks about acquisitions issues, that we all have these kind of fiddly acquisitions issues that the more mainstream collections do not have, that we all have good old cataloging head scratchers that drive our cataloging departments nuts or completely enamored of the issues that we have. They all require a specialized expertise and specialized skills that may not be the run-of-the-mill for a reference librarian, though certainly that's in our skills as well, and they certainly have skills that we may not. And they also have a specialized user base in common, of that it's not your typical freshman seminar that is going to be immediately attracted to these collections unless you can find that connection for that freshman seminar, in which case magic can happen. So where the literature tends to look at in this conversation of distinctive collections, the commonalities for administrative and organizational purposes and procedural purposes, basically, it doesn't necessarily talk a whole lot about how do you then slam these departments together in an administrative organizational chart, and how do we work together? Because if that's part of the idea of that we're all going to be in the same reporting line, then we should be in the same reporting line for more than just common interest, shouldn't we? But so that's one thing that I've been thinking about of, as I mentioned, Iowa has not been going toward a distinctive collections model, though we do report to the same associate university librarian. Some of the other conditions have made it easier to work with special collections that I've come to reflect on a little bit of that. For example, I know that not all of you as special collections may be in the same building as the most of your subject specialist librarians, for example. I work on the first floor in special collections and on the third floor. That makes it inordinately easy to pester them, which may or may not be a good thing. but it certainly leads to working together. But that has also come up into things of the collections themselves in terms of thinking of questions of what needs to be in special collections if I buy it. If it comes from a Latin American studies budget, and what needs to be there. What is already in special collections? Of not just thinking about the collection as special collections has their stuff, the circulating collections have their stuff. There is no hard and fast line in between the two. If it is in special collections, what is there that we can circulate and that we can make more accessible to the broader user population, and as well as to making it easier for them to use as well? If they can go see something in special collections, what else can they take home with them? What else can they consult, potentially also online? So in thinking of things, I'll start with a question of something like, does it need to be in special collections? And at this point, would you mind passing out those books? So, actually, and leave one with me. I don't know if any of you have ever seen this type of book before. This is a cartonero book. It's cardboard. There's a couple copies going around, different copies going around. It is made out of cardboard. Some of you, a cardboard corrugated box. Some of you, one of you will probably end up with one that was made out of an old Hellman's mayonnaise case. I noticed that when I was picking these out of the collection this morning. We circulate this. What about it says that it, but we do not circulate all of them. And about half of them are in special collections, and half of them are circulating. Actually, I have the Hellman's one, I just realized. So. The books that I pulled out of the stacks today are Argentine and Uruguayan. They're found in other parts of Latin America as well, and increasingly in some of the Romance language areas of Europe, as well as a few cartonera publishers in Africa. Why do I circulate them? Because that's what they're meant to do. Why do we preserve them? Because each one is a one-of-a-kind object. They're all hand-painted. They're all special and different, unique objects. They were created, the cartonera publishers began after the Argentine economic collapse in 2001, which also collapsed their publishing industry as well. And in order to make books still available, in order to provide some, in order to create new avenues in the publishing industry, in order to make books still accessible for working class Argentines, these started. They are bought, the cardboard is bought from cardboard recyclers who would otherwise be sending them back to a recycling center. So pay them a few extra pesos to drop off the better cardboard, the cleaner cardboard, and let's make a book out of it. These are, they're not particularly rare, and so I will make a decision on does it go to special collections based on holdings at other universities. The largest collection of these is at the University of Wisconsin. My counterpart there has collected over 1,200 of them. We have about 100 in our collection here. We have, it's 120. 70 of them are in special collections and 50 of them are circulating. So is it in a special collection somewhere else? Now, granted, I've already told you this is a one-of-a-kind unique item. So this copy, this particular cover design, complete with the Hellman's mayonnaise carton underneath, is not going to be in any other university. It's not going to be in any other collection anywhere else. But that said, the title, La Máquina de Pensar en Gladys, by Mario Levrero, a fairly major Uruguayan writer. That is going to be in several other, up to, some of these titles are held in about 24 other libraries, so it's going to be in at least a few special collections. Why not circulate it? There was kind of a, we were talking a couple months ago about a collection of material here at Iowa that was in special collections, but not really, and it was getting sent out to our storage unit, and they were calling it the medium rare collection, which made me laugh. Besides that, it sounds like we're talking about steak and not books. It made me laugh because it's stuff that is held in at least in probably several dozen other libraries. It's medium rare. It's not really rare. So if it's safe somewhere else, why not circulate it? And that's been one of my driving things on thinking of special collections and the collection of. So when I do find, for example, one of these that is not held, that we might have the first holding in it, somehow Paloma at Wisconsin has not yet gotten her hands on it, I will put it in special collections. Now, I know that if it then does end up at Wisconsin, it's still going in special collections, but whatever. It may still be the only copy that ends up here. There's thinking of other things of that unfortunately does kind of make out special collections to sound like another holdings location, another shelving location, if you will. But then there's also thinking about, for example, when I took my job here 5 years ago, I remember in the interview process and then also in my research around, okay, what's going on in Iowa, since it seems like I might be moving to Iowa, I picked up on this whole thing that we apparently have a ton of zines, a whole ton of science fiction fanzines. Maybe you too have heard about them sometime this week. And it also made me realize, but why aren't there zines in Spanish in our collections? And so that was taking something like a collection that was already really firmly in place and making it a, and then trying to figure out a way of what can I do to build a parallel and complementary collection that may not be a strong collection, zines may not have been present elsewhere in the Spanish language collection or in alternative publishing elsewhere in our local Spanish language collection. But again, capitalizing on what are we already doing and how can I make that stronger and better and more diverse. It's also taking in what do we have in special collections, such as something like a manuscript collection. Now, I'm not going to say, yes, let's circulate the Donoso papers, but I want to make sure that we're going to have a really strong collection to support the manuscript collections that we have, to support the Oscar Hahn papers, to support the Pedro Lastra papers. I want to make sure that we have the collections to support that. It's not that we have... It's looking at, sure, those papers aren't going anywhere. Those papers are going to be as much an archival collection as any. But thinking about it then across the line into the circulating collection as well. And I don't think that anything that I'm saying is particularly groundbreaking at all. And I hope that, I hope that others are thinking of this, but it's the perspective also of a liaison librarian, and again, how can I work with special collections, how can I work with, and what's coming next are the users. And in working with faculty and researchers and students, and how can we make those introductions between, as a liaison librarian, I know you in special collections, I know the faculty that I work with. Those are lines of networks that may or may not be capitalized on and may not already have existing connections. I may talk to folks in the faculty and I do see also the faculty as the gateway to the students, as we may talk to folks who will never walk into Special Collections on their own. But there may be things that I know about it that I can then transmit to the faculty and hopefully make those connections without you guys having to make further connections yourself. And they may be interested in collections that don't typically get used. And they may also then give me ways of bringing in collections that I know would get used by these people, but because they're not on your radar yet, we wouldn't otherwise know about. So, can you teach with your liaisons? And I hope that they do come into your classroom as well. Can your liaisons teach with your material? Can you train your liaisons to teach with your material, perhaps independently? Because again, you have the relationship dynamic of relationships that already exist and can change upon who is in the room. Can I teach independently? Now, it happens to be part of my interest in Special Collections was I kind of half thought about it going into library school, that maybe I wanted to be a Special Collections librarian. After two or three classes, I was convinced otherwise, but the interest still remained. It just meant that I didn't want to do it as my 40 hours a week. But so I've always said that I run short on talks, and I'm going to allow my counterparts to have more time. But I just wanted to kind of set that in motion there. So thank you, guys.
Hello, everyone. Could you hear me if I didn't have that on? Can't hear me. Okay. Because it's fairly echoey up here. Anyway, thank you for coming this afternoon. So I am a historian and also a librarian, and I work on the history of archaeology and antiquities in Mexico, which includes the history of codexes and books as well. So at the Newbery, for just 10 more days, I am the AR reference librarian, which means that I am an area specialist in the history of material, for the materials there that are about the history of Mexico, Brazil, the Hawaiian Islands, the Philippines, and the Pacific Islands, because those were Edward Ayer's areas of collection. And there are about 150,000 books in that collection. So I spend a lot of time with the ghost of this man, the one on the right, Edward E. Ayer. He left his father's home in Harvard, Illinois, just before the Civil War, at the age of 19. And he wanted to make his own way in the world. He didn't want to just follow in his father's footsteps. So he hitchhiked on the wagon trail to California, and most of the people who gave him rides were people he already knew, so he wasn't meeting, he didn't have to ask for rides from strangers very often. And in California, he took on laborious jobs such as mining and laundry, and then he joined the Union Army on the Western Front, and he was stationed in Arizona, and so this is, the war had started and he was in the war now, so he was stationed in Arizona, and he was stationed to protect a mine. And it was there that he had the first opportunity to fight against indigenous people, which is what perked his interest in the history of indigenous people. And then also at the mine, there was a library. And so for the first time in his life, he got to read a book other than the Bible. And that book was The History of the Conquest of Mexico. Hands up, who's read it? That's the normal reaction I get. So it's by William Hickling Prescott, and I read it as an undergrad doing a comparative study of bibliographies of Cortez. So that's the only reason I've read it. But if you're not familiar with it, it's a grand, sweeping, romantic epic about the Spanish arrival in the Valley of Mexico in 1519. So Ayer loved this book so much, he read it twice. And then at the first opportunity he got, he bought his own copies on credit. And then he wrote in the flyleaf about how important this was to him. So this is a photograph of the inside of his first copy of this book. And if you want to read this, the Newbery has it all online on their website. So on this flyleaf, he tells us about finding the books in Chicago at the Cobb and Pritchard bookstore on State Street in 1864. And he was astounded that the two-volume set was $17.50. And his reply is worth reading to you. What? I didn't suppose such books were worth more than 50 cents a volume. I finally said, "My name is Edward Ayer. I live at Harvard. I have been on the plains and in the war for 4 years. I returned a month since. My father has given me an interest in a store. I have $3.50 that I can spare you. If you will let me have a volume, then I will give you $3.50 for the next one when I return. I can do this every month until I've paid for them." So there was also the history of the conquest of Peru, and so he wanted all the volumes. "My return home was a triumphal procession. I was certainly the happiest boy in the world, and of course only touched the earth in high places." So this is now what the books look like, having been rebound. Ayer tells us, also in the flyleaf, that just 13 years later, after he made his fortune, because that's all it took to make his fortune in lumber after the Civil War, when he was a little wealthier, he took the books to London himself to the binder Joseph Zehensdorf, and had them rebound for $180. So he was very fond of flashy bindings like this. I love that he thought this book was worth buying on credit. He thought it was worth, thank you. He thought it was worth having rebound with a gilt edge all the way around, and it has a satin interior, and it has this box covers. But then he also wrote in it, but with pencil, so it works. So he loved this book so much that when he retired, he wrote his own autobiography by his own hand in the same epic sweeping style. He then had copies of that bound and sent to his friends, such as Julius Rosenthal, the president of Sears, and Marshall Field of the store in the museum. And then he waited for their letters of appreciation. And we have those at the Newbery. So I like to think of this as an early form of social media. Look what I did. Tell me how much you like it. But this is also how he shared his interest in the history of indigenous people with other librarians such as Hubert Howe Bancroft and Henry E. Huntington. So as I said, Ayer earned his wealth through lumber sales in the 1870s and 80s, and at this point he began collecting materials on the indigenous people from the North to South Pole, Pacific Islands, and then later the Philippine Islands. So he was deeply interested in materials that were handwritten, particularly by members of the church, and in Spanish. And I'm still trying to get to the heart of that passion, because I don't think he was Catholic, and his wife translated the materials for him. His Spanish got better over time, but at first I don't think he read it. But what I did find in one of his letters, in his correspondence, was that he believed the Spanish had colonized Illinois. Nobody skeptical? So for that reason, he thought it was important to learn about them. So we see him here in 1894, already immersed in his collection of Indian arts that he himself purchased when he would go back and forth between Arizona and Chicago, and his books. So this was painted by his nephew, Elbridge Burbank, who he sent out to paint over 4,000 portraits of Native American artists, and the Newbery now has at least 60 of those oil paintings and about 300 sketches. So Ayer became a member of the Board of Trustees of the Newbery Library, and he was one of the founders of the Field Museum. And part of his Native American artifacts collection was on display at the World's Fair in 1893. And he then donated that most of that collection, and then eventually a million pieces just to the Field Museum. It seems that he was a cantankerous sort that threatened to resign from the Field and the Newbery whenever he wanted to press a point, but he never left either institution. So one of my favorite letters between him and his niece is one where he says, "Don't tell anybody, but I'm going to resign from the Newbery." But I never found any letter following that. So because of his time in the military and his interest in Prescott's book, he became interested in documents that reflected contact moments and conflict moments between indigenous people and Europeans and later Americans. So starting in 1900, Ayer began donating items from his collection of 80,000 items to the Newbery Library. In part, he donated those materials because he wanted someone to make a list of the books. He had hired several people to do this for him, and he never got the list he wanted. And then he had attached a librarian to the collection, which he had in three places in Chicago and Wisconsin. And he himself spent a lot of time with the collection, and they were receiving a lot of letters asking to have access to it. So he said he would put it in the Newbery Library so that people could have access to it. And he then attached the librarian to the collection, so he put Clara Smith in the library as well. And she then was his librarian for 50 years. So in the end, he thought he gave about 50,000 materials to the library, to the Newbery Library, and because that list didn't materialize at the time, we don't really know if it was that high or not. So the librarian that he attached was his own niece, and over the 50 years that she was his librarian, her name was Clara Smith, and she became the nexus of his collecting because she became the point of contact for booksellers and researchers and people that were sent out to create transcripts of documents in the archives of the Indies. So the Newbery is not the only place to have these transcripts, but they are pretty amazing. Ayer sent people to Spain and Mexico and Texas and Cuba to hand copy the archives. In one case, I found a letter where he was furious because somebody had hired their mother to do it because she had good Spanish. Clara Smith received so many requests. Oh, sorry, they already put them in the Newbery. So Ayer's bequest encouraged others to donate their own collections there and to collect to supplement his collections. So, for example, the William Greenlee collection is there, and it's a Lusophone collection. And there's some Brazilian material in the Ayer collection, but mostly it's in Spanish or English. So, and by the way, I'm only speaking about the Mexican pieces or Guatemalan pieces in the Ayer collection. There are a lot of materials about the United States. So Greenlee had been collecting rather randomly. For example, we do have a church manuscript from the 1500s from Germany. That's the type of material he was collecting before he decided to supplement the Ayer collection. So, and now a little bit about the documents in the collection. Oh, sorry, that is Ayer's library, which was on the first floor of the Newbery, and the original vault was back there. And this is where he would sit, because he continued to come in there and work until 1927 when he passed away. All right, so the documents. Because of his interest in contact between whites and indigenous people, he collected these materials that would speak to this moment. So this means that the Newbery essentially has specialized mini collections. So, for example, they have hundreds of dictionaries in indigenous languages. There are over 400 Indian captivity narratives and a few hundred facsimiles of books, facsimiles of pre-Columbian books. So a fine example of his interest is this map, which we always call the Cortez map, but you can't find it in the catalog by that name. It's also known as the Nuremberg map because that's where it was published in 1521. You guys have all seen this map before, right? Yeah, and some of you have seen the black and white copies of it, right? Yes. In fact, anybody at Salaam, if you went to the library cocktail party, they had the black and white one out. So it's a hand-colored map of Tenochtitlan, the Aztec city, published in 1524. And Barbara Mundy has argued that Cortez saw a map drawn by an indigenous person. He then based his sketch on that map. And then he sent that sketch back to Europe, to Spain, to the king, it made its way to Nuremberg, and this is the mapmaker's artistic license. So this map is actually bound in the Latin edition. And the Newbery is one of the few places that still has it bound in the book. And as far as we know, there's only one other hand-colored map, which is in Vienna. And Barbara Mundy has also argued that she thinks it was hand-painted in the 19th century. So I always, my mind is boggled by the artistry and the arrogance of a person who would just think that this was just the neatest coloring book. But so Ayer was also interested in ongoing examples of contact, and because of that, the Newbery has many documents that are court cases in which indigenous people contested losing their land in the Valley of Mexico. So I don't like to think of these as documents of conquest, but as documents of persistence. So one particular set of documents that you may already know about is the Tetchinoan Codexes, and the Newbery has two of these. We know that there were about 50 to 75 of them made in the same workshop in New Spain, and about 50 of them, their whereabouts are known now. So they were made by people of indigenous descent who were trained in the Western style. And the documents are intended to be used to document land rights by showing the continued presence of particular families on plots of land and particular villages going back to the pre-Columbian period. So you may notice that, and then maybe it's too hard to tell in this light, but this is not the finest paper that could be produced in Mexico at the time. It's on very rough amate paper, and that's deliberate to make the document look older than it is, to give it a sense of authenticity. And this particular codex, which is the Codex Mbuala, came to the Newbery in the same way that the Popol Vuh came to the Newbery, which was through the book dealer Alphonse Pinart, and I'll talk about him a little bit more later. So in Mexico, the church archives were more or less emptied by the government decree by the end of the 1860s, and many of those documents were purchased by Mexican book collectors and then sold out of the country on their deaths. So sometimes, though, government officials sold off documents, like this one. So this is a map of Teotihuacan, and if you've ever been there, and I bet half of you have, it doesn't look anything like this. So, but Ayer purchased this map from an unofficial book dealer named Wilson Wilberforce Blake that was living in Mexico City and was also editing a newspaper, and it made its way to Chicago in 1894. The year before Blake had acquired it, the year before being 1893, Blake had acquired it from the national archaeologist in Mexico who was named Leopoldo Batres. He was the first national archaeologist. And Batres, who people are very suspicious of, he claimed to have gotten it from an indigenous person that found it in a stone box at Teotihuacan. So that's a bit of a strange story. But nevertheless, it is one of three similar documents, and one of the others like it is now at the Museum of Natural History in New York, and the third one is in Mexico. And Batres was actually the only person legally able to sell a map like this in Mexico. So he was the only person who could make that call. And one of the stipulations that would allow him to make that call was if it was a duplicate. And so having all three maps together, deciding this one and the one in New York were in poor condition, he was allowed to sell them off to fund other excavations. One of the legacies that comes with maintaining an archive like Ayer's is that multiple generations of the same Indian nation or the same family are able to view the materials. And one example of that is the book we commonly call the Popol Vuh. So the Popol Vuh documents many of the Mayan creation myths and provides details about Mayan religion, cosmology, and society in about 1550, when Catholic conversion had barely begun in that area. It's now the National Book of Guatemala, and the Newbery's copy is the oldest known handwritten copy. And when people come to see this book, they expect it to be a pictographic Mayan book, which would be very rare, right, because so many of them were burned, but people do expect it to have images in the way that the reproductions do. So the first version of the Popol Vuh was written around the middle of the 16th century. It probably was pictographic and in Romanized Mayan Quiche. And it was probably based on pre-Columbian books. But when Francisco Jimenez did this version in 1703, he left all the images out. He had been in Guatemala for 33 years. He was a Dominican friar, and he was distressed by the fact that the conversion of the indigenous people in the highlands was not complete. So he wanted to find a way to reach people and convert them to Catholicism. So he thought, well, what I will do is write down what they do believe in. And so that's what this is. This is an accumulation of oral histories and documents that he found. He had created a number of documents, actually. Only three of them made their way to the Newbery. So Jimenez's work stayed in Guatemala until 1861, and when this was sold to the French scholar Abbot Charles Antoine Brasseur de Bourbourg, and he took it to Paris for study and publication, so he made a facsimile, and the Newbery has a copy of the facsimile. And before his death, he sold it to the linguist Alphonse Pinart, who was known for the Aleutian masks he had collected in Alaska. However, upon Bourbourg's death in 1874, it went to the National Library in Paris, and it took Pinart almost 10 years before he could convince them to sell it back to him. And so Pinart was a passionate book collector. He took all of his family's money, so they gave him a certain allowance to go exploring and buying books. And then when his father passed away, he was factored into the family business, but he took all of the family business money and put it into Mexican books. He then married a wealthy woman who was a scholar of Mexican books, as she was half Mexican, and took all of her money and put it into Mexican books. And you think she would have liked that, but she divorced him. She then went to Mexico, bought a conquistador's house, which she got Phoebe Hearst to pay for, and spent the rest of her life slagging him off. But my next book will be about her. He's not as interesting as her, but after she divorced him, he was broke. So he had to sell off his books. And then he through an intermediary French bookseller, Pinart sold the Popol Vuh, the Codex Sempoala, and several other books that are at the Newbery to Edward Ayer. And Ayer then, when it came to the Newbery as part of the 1910 bequest. So in September of 2001, the Guatemalan consul and a group of priests from Mayan priests and elders from Chichicastenango came to the Newbery and performed a blessing ceremony for the document and for the staff that cared for the Popol Vuh. So this was their way of showing respect for the book, but also for the work that the Newbery put into conserving it, housing it, and making it available to the public. And is Giselle here? Oh, so I was expecting her. But Giselle works here at the University of Iowa, and she was one of the conservationists at the Newbery at that time, and she was one of the people that they blessed. And one of the things that they did was take off the old binding, which I'm not sure if they know from what period that was from, but it was not helping the book. It wasn't supporting the book. So they took it off. They scanned it and made a facsimile of it. You can see it online. And then they gave several copies of the facsimiles to people in Guatemala. So that's some of the ways in which they've made it more accessible. And then in September 2015, the same group returned with some of their younger people that they were now training into this process of blessing the book. And what we found out then is that they will return every 4 years on the September equinox to bless the book. And when they do these ceremonies, they bring candles and flowers and staffs, and they don't light the candles. And then they give everybody a job associated with the book. So, for example, my job was to walk around the building spreading flowers at the four cardinal points in honor of anybody who had ever read the book. So most of what I've told you today about Ayer and his collecting is what I have gleaned from his correspondence, particularly that with Clara Smith, and her correspondence with researchers and booksellers. But there's only about 1.5 Hollinger boxes of this material at the Newbery. So I'm looking to see if there are other places that have Ayers correspondence. And people come there thinking his business correspondence will be there, but we don't even have very much of that either. So historians have pointed out that much of what he collected and how he collected it is, the information is lost or confusing. And he honestly didn't leave us a whole lot of information about his collecting habits, but through looking at his vendor records, we've been able to track a bit of what types of things he was getting from particular people. And so this is just my way of saying that there's so much more to be learned about how Ayer compiled his collection, and I'm going to keep looking into that, and thank you for listening today.
Good afternoon. Thanks to everyone for making time to spend a little time with documents from Latin America, and thanks to our sponsors as well. Lisa referenced a question about subject librarians and liaisons and how they might participate in special collections work, promotion, teaching, instruction. And what I have here is basically a case study of a subject librarian working with a distinctive collection in the Special Collections Unit of Michigan State Universities. Before I go into a discussion about the exhibit that I helped to create, or primarily created, I need to tell you a little bit about our Comics Forum. And MSU's Comics Forum is an annual weekend event that brings together scholars and students and creators and fans of comics and graphic storytelling. And 2017 marked the 10th anniversary of the forum. The force behind the forum is Ryan Clater, an assistant professor in the Residential College and himself a prize-winning cartoonist. He started this forum. And there are many campus units that sponsor it, including the MSU libraries. And some additional sponsors have included the Journal of Popular Culture, the Capital Area District Library, and other parties. So to coincide with the forum that took place in February of 2016, I was asked to exhibit comics from Latin America. But I didn't really know what I was getting into when I accepted this invitation. I knew that we had a very large collection of comics in general, the largest of its kind in the world, I'm told, which is a publicly accessible collection of comics, with over 250,000 cataloged items. And even the Latin American comics, which really are a very small slice of that total, it's still a very extensive collection with large numbers of titles from many countries and a wide variety of types of comic art. So I had just begun a secondary assignment in Special Collections a few months earlier, was not very well acquainted with our comic art holdings, even though I had been acquiring comics from the region for Special Collections with some increasing frequency in recent years. I thought this would be a good opportunity for me to really get to know what we have. Did you turn it off? Thank you. Does anybody know what this might be about? let's try opening it again.
Oh, here it is.
Not sure what that was about. Anyway, to get back to the Comics Forum, the main activities of the forum take place in Snyder Phillips Hall, which is an historic campus building and a residence hall, and it's also the home of MSU's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. It's a building with flexible use spaces that work very well for this event. There's a theater for the forum's keynote address, an exhibition gallery, classrooms for panel presentations and roundtables, and space for the Artists' Alley exhibition, where comics artists are provided tables for showing and selling their wares. Now, the Artists' Alley takes place in the exhibition gallery and in the adjacent rooms, and like I said, there's also classrooms for these other activities. And in 2016, the event kicked off with a film on a Thursday evening, followed by the keynote address on a Friday night. And what this announcement is the announcement of who our keynote speaker will be. Maybe some of you recognize the drawing there. Well, the keynote speaker was Sergio Aragonés, who's probably the world's most awarded comic artist, contributor to Mad Magazine for about 50 years. But anyway, that was a pretty terrific thing to land for the forum. Also on the Saturday of the forum, Randy Scott, the comic art bibliographer, offered a tour of the library's special collections unit with an emphasis, of course, on the comic art collection. Let's see. Oh, there we go. There's Sergio again. He's best known for his contributions, like I said, to Mad Magazine for his and for his creation of Gru the Wanderer, someone we'll see in a second. The live stream of his address at the forum is linked from the forum website or can be found on YouTube if you're interested. And this is the forum poster that he created. So the guy with the swords is Gru the Wanderer, and there's his dog, Ruferto, and behind them is MSU's Sparty statue, because we're the Spartans, and it's surrounded by bewildered campus visitors. Just to show you a few pictures of what the Artists' Alley exhibition hall looks like, it's a juried exhibition. There are more people that want to show than we have space for. And here's an example of the kinds of panel presentations and roundtables that we have. I don't actually have the page from the 2016 forum, but you get the idea. And this is the gallery where some of the exhibit needed to be placed. It would extend from this gallery, however, into six large cases that were in an adjacent corridor. Now, I knew that I wanted to create some engaging labels and not just present all these comic book covers with no contextual information whatsoever. But on the other hand, too much information would not be appropriate either. The gallery walls that you see here don't lend themselves well to displaying comic books. Even though the gallery is staffed when it's open, security would be a real concern, because some of the comic books we have are quite valuable. And so the solution was to create large poster reproductions of selected comic book covers and put those on the gallery walls. And this also worked well during the weekend forum when the gallery space was filled up with the Artists' Alley, because you could still see the posters very readily, you know, behind the exhibitors and in between their tables. Now, there are original pieces, of course, that could be exhibited in some flat cases that are in the gallery, as well as a couple of wall cases. Now, this is the exhibit poster just for the Latin American Comics exhibit. And our graphic artist, Teresa Moore, came up with a great design for a poster. And then these same design elements were carried over into some labels for the large corridor cases. And I think that having a design theme like this is really useful for unifying a spatially dispersed exhibit like this one. For the poster, I just wrote a paragraph about the history of Latin American comics, a little bit about the exhibit, and also invited viewers to visit special collections. Okay, this photo shows two of the large, almost 8-foot wide corridor cases. The first one there, actually what you see there are two. And beyond that partition where the wall protrudes, there's a third one, and then the exact same setup on the opposite side of the corridor. Apart from the days of the forum, this corridor gets a fair amount of foot traffic because there are classrooms on either side, and the residential college administrative offices and some faculty offices are up there as well. My goal was to present a kind of sweeping overview of the range of comic art from the region, including some of the more iconic characters and series, but also some newer things. I wanted to include comics for kids, for teens, for adults, from contemporary publications to some of the earliest, such as the Brazilian children's magazine Otico Tico, which began publishing in 1905 and included cartoons and strips. So as I said, I needed to fill 6 8-foot-wide cases, and I just decided to organize these overall geographically, although not every country from Latin America is represented there, with country labels and a few informational labels. So the countries for which we have the most important and extensive holdings got the most space. So Mexico, you see in this slide, got an entire case. There were comics from 8 countries, Central America and Puerto Rico, and also a selection of U.S. Latino, Latina comics and graphic novels in these cases. And then within the geographic groupings, they were grouped roughly by genre, as we use the term with respect to the MSU comics collection. So you can see the terms in the slide, and we apply these as local subject headings in our catalog records. There are 47 of them. Those are just a few listed there. So aesthetically, this kind of grouping within the geographic grouping seemed to make the most sense. The individual issues were selected mostly because I liked the covers the best, but in some cases we had some rare first issues that I wanted to show. Oops. Okay, because I didn't have good photos from the items when they were actually in the cases. There was too much glare. I photographed some of them here, and I'll just show you a couple examples. So on the bottom left, you have La Familia Burrón, which is one of the best-known and one of the longest-running Mexican comics. It was published from 1948 to 2009 and is characterized by a sharp social satire and centers on a poor working-class family in Mexico City. And next to that is Rolando el Rabioso, a mock Arthurian romance comic. It's very popular and also one of the longest-running Mexican series from the mid-1930s to 1974. And above those, you see examples of Los Supermachos and Los Agachados, both by an artist who goes by the name Rius, R-I-U-S. It's really hard to say. And he's also a prolific political cartoonist. Now to the right, something completely different. You have a romance comic series called El Libro Semanal, which is the bride with the poker cards there. I don't want to tell you what that's about. And then to the right of that, oh, and then there's the one called The Stewardess. And then to the right of that is an example of detective comics. Now, this is a grouping of Chilean comics that were all published by the same outfit for just a few years. It was a very short-lived endeavor, but there is a very interesting story about that press on YouTube, and so I tried to see what all we had from them in the collection and put them together in the Chilean section of the case. Now, this is just an example of a few items I chose from a very large collection of Latino comics that we have. Now, this is another view of the gallery, and it shows the glass wall that runs almost the entire length of the opposite side of the gallery from what you saw in that previous slide. And you can also see how it gets its name, the Lookout Gallery. It looks out over the dining hall of the residence hall. And it lets in a lot of natural light because the far wall of the dining hall is also a glass wall. So for the flat cases in the gallery, I decided to group some things thematically. And so those were the four groupings that I created. One of them is of Colombian zines. Like Lisa, I also collect Colombian zines. And one of the groupings was educational comics, many of them from Cuba, but also from other regions as well. And comic scholarship. We also collect a lot of books about comics in all languages, not just in English. And this next slide shows just one of the items that was in the case of Westerns. I had a number of examples, mostly Mexican, but I included the volume shown here, which is the first volume of a 2011 reprint collection of the King Features newspaper strip, The Cisco Kid. So it's not a Latin American comic strip, but it was drawn by the great Argentine artist José Luis Salinas. In the mid-20th century, many top artists left Latin America in search of work in Europe and in the U.S. because the comics markets in their own countries were becoming dominated by translated editions of U.S. comics. And I didn't notice it when I first pulled it, but it happens to have an introduction by Sergio Aragonés, explaining how much he loved Western comic books when he was growing up. That left two wall cases in the gallery, and I just made a couple of groupings here. Actually, the one Tintin in South America was the idea of my colleague Randy Scott, the comic art bibliographer. We know that Tintin traveled the world, including the Amazon and other points in South America, so we put some editions in that case in various languages. And I also selected some illustrated books by the cartoonist Rius. He was very successful in some of his illustrated books. You may have heard of a couple of them. One was called Cuba for Beginners. I mean, they were originally in Spanish, then translated into a lot of languages. One was called Cuba for Beginners, and the other, Marx for Beginners, was particularly successful. It was like in all the Barnes and Nobles, and it may be still in print as far as I know. So I selected also some of these types of books in several languages for this case. These are just the labels that were in the cases. So these are the poster reproductions that were on the walls in the gallery, since I didn't want to put up the originals there. They weren't going to be behind glass. So I have here just a few examples of the posters that I made. And in this one, and they were about 30 by 22, 30 by 23 inches in size, I wanted to select some of the best known or historically important series. This slide shows covers of two very well-known Brazilian funny kid comics and the exhibit label for one of them, Monica. The character on the right, El Menino Maluquinho, is a Dennis the Menace-like character. Now for something completely different, this is an important science fiction comic from Argentina. Its creator, Héctor Germán Osterheld, was a well-known writer and publisher. The plot concerns alien invasion that all takes place in Buenos Aires. It was published in 1957 to 1959, but he rewrote and reissued it in the 1960s. Sadly, he became a target of the Argentine military dictatorship in the 1970s and was disappeared, as was most of his family, his four daughters as well. Another Argentine title is Fierro, El Fierro. We have a complete run of the 100 issues of the original Fierro. The artists whose names appear on the cover are kind of a pantheon of top Argentine artists, starting with Enrique Breccia, who's the first name up there, whose father was Alberto Breccia, one of the all-time great Latin American comic artists who worked with Osterheld. This is a really well-known comic character, the little Andean condor, Condorito. And in this cover, you see Condorito surprised by his little nephew, Cone, jumping out of the egg there. Turns out that Cone has become orphaned and has to go live with Condorito. And Cone eventually got his own series. And just a very well-known, very popular comic. So Calimán is a Mexican comic that was published between 1965 and 1991. He's a rather exotic character. His adventures take place in places that are nothing like Mexico. There's the Super Machos again with the label that I had created for it. Here is one of the two Borderlands posters that I made. Now, this Cisco Kid is not the original strip that was in the volume that I showed before. This came out later, and this was a real comic rather than the strips. The last examples here of the gallery posters are the covers of two contemporary comics from Central America. In the hall cases, I exhibited these and a handful of others from Guatemala and Nicaragua and Costa Rica. And there were probably another, possibly 15 of these, but I'm not going to go through all those. In conclusion, I would just say that preparing the exhibit was a big undertaking because I also had a day job at the time. But it was a great continuing education experience, and it illustrates one way in which non-special collections librarians can enhance their knowledge of popular culture production, in this case, while also promoting special collections holdings beyond the walls of the library. That's it. Thank you.
If we can have Lisa come back up to the front table. We do have some time for some questions. And if you do have questions, because of the challenging acoustics of this room, if I ask you to try and speak up and please state your name and your institution before asking a question. While you're thinking, I have a question for Mary Jo. Yes. So I'm a cataloger. So coming from a cataloging perspective, you did mention the genre terms, the local genre terms that were in the records. Were there other particular things in the catalog records that helped you in putting together the exhibit, or that you wished were in the records that would have helped? Oh, and make sure you're speaking into the microphone.
To tell you the truth, I spent an awful long time just going through the ranges. I mean, I had a sense of which countries had the greatest comic production and what we had the most holdings of, but I didn't use the catalog a whole lot. I was aware of the genre term usage, and I did want to get some of those different types of comics represented in the exhibit, but I spent a great deal of time just going through and seeing what I thought was unique or that caught my eye.
Thank you. Did you buy anything for the exhibit?
Well, I had been buying comics for a while, but I didn't buy anything specifically for the exhibit.
Yes.
In terms,
we're doing Jewish, Latin American, and Caribbean at the University of Florida because we have a Judaic library as well. What are the great things that you say that's going to be our contribution to heritage preservation?
Well, our collecting follows historic campus strengths in large part. I think that many selectors would agree with that. So we have had a traditional focus on Brazil and on Mexico, more on the social sciences and history side than on the literature side. But that's really what drives it, I think, is the local priorities. I don't know if Lisa would have something else to say about that, but that's the number one thing. Well, we work with vendors, and we create gathering plans. We can't select title by title. That would be a monumental tax. There wouldn't be time to do anything else. So we work with vendors largely from the region. There are a few based in the U.S. that we work with, and we give them profiles, and they basically gather books, new imprints for us based on those descriptions that we provide. And based on our local needs and our local priorities, we will write up something that says, these are the highest priorities, these are the lower priorities, and don't send me any of this. I don't want any political biography. I don't want any collections of journalists writing, not at MSU. I don't want that. So exclusions. And then we also monitor and review those shipments that they send us. And if they're going off track, we return them, and that gets their attention, and they really want to work with, they really want us to be happy, and we want to support them in their work, because their work is absolutely vital. We really could not do it at all without our vendors. And our relationships are based very much on, they're very much in personal business relationships, I would say. It's a little different than working with Yankee, for example. You're welcome.
Either of the other panelists?
Mine goes a lot farther to literature. And so one thing I also think about is, what can our collection do for others that nobody else can? Or at least, what can we do? So Mary Jo and I are both in the Big Ten Consortium. What can I provide that Mary Jo is not going to provide? And one of the answers for Latin American literature is even down to a well-stocked liberal arts college library is going to buy the major publishers. So the next big novel or collection of stories by Cesar Aira that gets published by Planeta or Alfaguara, even Grinnell College is going to get that. Even maybe like Co-College up in Cedar Rapids is going to get that. We should have it, but it's not going to be my concern. Our vendor will hopefully just send that automatically, and if they don't, what I want them to do and what I'm going to spend my time doing is making sure that we're going to get publishers like the little indie literature publishers, where a lot of really interesting literature is happening right now, a lot of regional publishers outside of the capitals. That's where a lot of kind of interesting stuff that's going to, maybe Iowa has the only copy in the U.S. and it circulates, and that's something that we can share. So it's building beyond, my campus is my number one concern, but then I'm also looking to serving the state of Iowa and the Big Ten Consortium as a secondary audience.
So the AIR collection came with certain parameters, but it also came with an endowment. And although the majority of the Mexican material is from the colonial period, there are no requirements that says the collection has to be locked in time. So the curator of Americana has been expanding the collection into the 19th and 20th century by purchasing materials like materials related to Alcatraz. Because again, the idea is to find those moments of contact and conflict. So we could look for materials from the Mexican-American War, or if we could get materials from the Zapatista uprising, we'd be able to add those kinds of materials to the collection, because they're all about that topic without being locked in time.
Other questions? Yes.
I have a question for you about those cardboard books. It looks like when you're assessing the circulating or non-circulating, you're looking to see what other libraries have them, but it looks like the covers are hand-painted, so even if they have the same book inside, they don't have the same book.
They're all different.
So if you have the same text, how different are the covers?
They can actually be pretty wildly different, and they can also even come from different publishers. So a couple of the books that I have, I might have, so there are cartoneras in probably about 24 different countries. And sometimes, and they're fairly fearless about approaching well-known authors as well and saying, hey, do you have a short story or something we could publish? And sometimes they say yes, and here you go. But that short story is kind of what the publisher reserves for cartonera, so that, or that writer, and that writer might turn around and give it to another cartonera in another country. So it could come out from Eloisa in Argentina, and it could come out from Sarita in Peru. And so in which case, it's going to be even a completely different layout. But yeah, so some of the cartoneras have a pretty recognizable style. If you put out a table full of cartoneras, I'm gonna say that one's from Eloisa. So it's not, sure, they can be done in different colors and whatnot, but the style's gonna be pretty much the same. I think a couple of the ones that I circulated also have, the ones from Uruguay have something actually pasted on them. Like one of them had like a translated Popeye comic, if you saw that one. Another one might have something completely different pasted on it.
Do you think that uniqueness will change your mind about circulating them? Or?
Generally, no. Basically, as long as I think that the cover is going to stay intact through circulation, I don't care what the cover is. I'll circulate it. I've had some. I just bought one in Mexico a couple months ago. It's a cartonera coloring book. And so it has a pack of crayons glued on it. That one is not circulating. And really only for the fact that the crayons are not going to survive circulation. If it were just a coloring book, I probably would have still bought it just kind of for the fun of having a cartonera coloring book. And I may or may not have circulated it. But yeah, so it's basically, I've bought another one that had kind of like a tin cutout and a mirror kind of pasted on it. That one didn't circulate. Actually, Giselle just came in, and she has, who both did the Popol Vuh and has stabilized my cartonera books for circulation. So her job goes many directions. So yeah, she's gone from working with the Popol Vuh to working with cardboard books. That's all right.
Well, if you had
Thank
put
you for
it
coming.
In a regular collection.
Mm-hmm.
How would you have felt about somebody coloring it?
What was that?
If you had put the coloring book in the regular collection, how would you have felt about somebody coloring in it?
You know, I'm also the kind of person that it doesn't hugely bother me if people write in the margins. So, yeah, I mean, some of you guys, it might give you the heebie-jeebies, but it's the life of a book. A book is not a permanent thing. It's not a permanent object. So, I also believe in, so like our zine collection, we catalog title by title, because to me it's description as preservation, that the description of it is a record that the thing existed, and that the description may be more, a catalog record may be more description of it than has ever existed before. And so it's a historical record. It's cataloged as a historical record of that this material existed. We're describing it to the best of our ability based on whatever bibliographic data may or may not be available. I wouldn't mind circulating the zine collection that we have, but we go through way too much trouble to acquire and describe it. That, yeah.
Question in the back?
So I was wondering, just for your experience with
to let people touch books at the Newbery. The tactile experience is really important. But that is one of the few books where we ask people to let me turn the pages. So I think they were surprised when they saw me doing that. But I didn't interfere with them picking the book up and reading it out loud. And as I said, they brought candles, they brought flowers, and so they were allowed to spread those, and they didn't light the candles out of respect for our role as guardians of it. We have numerous materials that are sacred to not just to tribes in the United States, but around the world, and so we've actually posted protocols on our website to allow people knowledge about what they might find sensitive there, and so that we can allow them as much access to the material as possible within the confines of us being able to protect the material. So, in general, we don't really interfere with people as long as they're not, as long as they're being respectful for the books. So, we, for example, they don't take anything out of the building.
More questions? Okay, if not, I'd like to once again thank our speakers, if you'll join me. We'll make sure we get the books.
Yeah,
first
collected.
Okay. So.
Do you guys have a bunch of those?
Hmm?
Do you guys have any of those?
Yeah, we have some. Yeah, they have some.